Next up on This Week in Law, Marianne Franks and Alexander Davey join me. I'm Denise Howell. We're discussing ending cyber exploitation, differences in approach between the U.S. and the EU in data protection. We'll talk about the TPP, commercials in movies, and data gathering refrigerators, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWIL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 324, recorded October 16th, 2015. Data for beer? This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. My co-host, Sarah Pearson, is not with us. She's off in Seoul, Korea, doing some great stuff for Creative Commons there. We'll miss her, but we'll soldier on without her. We'll see her soon. We do have two great panelists joining us on This Week in Law today. Marianne Franks teaches law at the University of Miami School of Law. She is the Legislation and Tech Policy Director and Vice President of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and the co-producer of the documentary film Hot Girls Wanted. Hello, Marianne. It's great to meet you.
It's great to meet you as well. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you on the show. Also joining us is Alexander Davey. Alex is the co-founder of Riggs Davey, a law firm in Nashville, Tennessee, where he represents technology industry clients and startups, as well as private investment funds. Hello, Alex.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. Glad you could join us. All right. I think we will start out talking about some developments in California on the front of cyber exploitation and the Attorney General Kamala Harris's efforts to end that kind of crime. Marianne, you've done a ton of work and advising in this area. And maybe you should start out by telling us about the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and what its purpose and goal is.
Certainly. The Cyber Civil Rights Initiative was founded a few years ago by a victim of nonconsensual pornography, Holly Jacobs, who was frustrated by not only her own personal experience in being a target of this crime, but also with her inability to get help, either from law enforcement or really from anywhere else. And we came together in the CCRI as a group of lawyers, victims, and legal scholars to talk about the problems that we face in terms of all the new ways that the internet allows people to harm other people, and to focus specifically, at least in the beginning, on the problem of what is sometimes colloquially called revenge porn, but also to broaden our scope to the various forms of harassment and abuse that people can experience through the use of social media and the web. And so what we try to do at the CCRI is to educate the public, first of all, about these forms of harassment, and also to advocate for legislative reform where necessary, and also technological reform in responding to these types of abuses.
Great. So Wednesday of this week, Kamala Harris, California already has some of the most extensive laws on the books trying to address these problems of any of the states. And we should talk in a moment about what you think, Marianne, about a state-oriented approach toward regulating this and prosecuting these kinds of events, or a federal-oriented one and where things stand on both fronts. But in California, just this week, Kamala Harris has launched an initiative that is a hub with all kinds of tools for victims, for law enforcement, It is available at oag.ca.gov/cyber-exploitation. There are technology industry best practices. This year has seen quite a lot of movement in the technology industry to help victims of these kinds of crimes, hasn't it, Marianne?
Yes, we've seen a lot of attention being paid to the issue, partly, or I'd say probably principally, because there were many victims who were willing to go public with their stories. As one can imagine, it's very difficult to go public with your story when something like this has happened, when there's been an invasion of privacy of this kind. So it really is, so much credit is due to the victims who were willing to talk about this. And once people did talk about it, I think there was clear attention paid to it by legislators and others about how serious this was and how big of a problem it really is. And fortunately, we've seen quite a lot of developments in the last couple of years on the part of law enforcement, legislators, and technology companies to try to combat this.
So did you work with the California Attorney General's office on the initiative they launched this week?
We did. The Cyber Civil Rights Initiative has been working with them, I think, pretty much since the beginning that they started this over a year ago to put this together.
And is California, since you are paying attention to all of the states, are they way out in front on this issue, or are other states working along the same lines?
Well, I think what we've seen in California is there's much more attention being paid to the issue of non-consensual pornography in isolation and talking about all the different ways in which one can attack that problem, including raising awareness and making sure that tech companies are on board. So I think that California really is a leader in the sense that it is trying to put the focus on this and really talk about multiple ways of attacking the problem. Other states, I think, have stronger laws in some cases against non-consensual pornography, but California has really gone out of its way to make sure that the social and educational part of this, which is really key to so much of this, is really full front and center.
Alex, I'm wondering about your perspective on this from someone who advises startup and tech companies. Obviously, if you're doing any kind of social aspect in connection with your service or site, there's a danger that someone could post exploitive photos or videos and that you as a company could get involved in trying to alleviate or remediate what has happened. So what do you think of California now giving these guidelines to companies and trying to help them navigate those shoals?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good thing. I think most companies do not have issues with attempts to pare this activity down. I think, you know, not only are companies concerned about their liability, but they're also concerned about the publicity, and obviously, if you're a legitimate business, you don't want to become a haven to revenge porn. I mean, you know, companies like Facebook and YouTube, you know, do not allow you to post sexually explicit videos on there. So, I mean, for the most part, there's not a whole lot of liability here because the companies themselves are screening this out, and then the other side of that is you have the Communications Decency Act, which does shield interactive website services from a lot of the liability, you know, if something got posted and got through their filter. But, you know, assuming the legislative response is not let's make website providers strictly liable for what gets put on their website, this is not a huge issue on tech companies' radar screens. It's a big issue in terms of they want to prevent it. They don't want to be associated with it because I think just about everyone thinks it's pretty vile activity. But mm-hmm. From a legal perspective, thankfully we haven't seen too much in the way of liability yet.
And Marianne, it seems to me like what Alex is saying is dead on, and that companies certainly would want to work with victims and not want to, you know, be the cause or source of this kind of information being available. But at the same time, they want to make sure that they're not making themselves a target as well. As far as legal action goes, Alex mentioned the Communications Decency Act, which provides a good deal of protection to third-party intermediaries, but not when someone is committing a crime using their services, correct?
Well, the Communications Decency Act is a little tricky in this regard, because while it's true that intermediaries have this immunity when it comes to being sued, they don't have immunity if it is a question of copyright or intellectual property, and they don't have this immunity if it's a violation of federal criminal law. So there's been a lot of cases to suggest that state criminal law will not trump the CDA, but federal criminal law certainly would. So if, in fact, non-consensual pornography were to become something that was criminalized by Congress, then we would be talking about a shifting landscape of liability for a lot of these intermediaries. And I think that it's important to keep in mind that while it may be true and fair to say that reputable companies are not happy about non-consensual pornography being used on their platforms, there are a lot of non-reputable companies out there. There's, in fact, entire websites that are dedicated to revenge porn. So we have to think about those kinds of entities as well. When we're thinking about the good guys, you also have to think about the bad guys. And you also have to think about the companies who may not be thrilled about non-consensual pornography, but are not concerned about it either, because what they're really concerned about with is profit. So if it isn't really a priority for them and they have a lot of immunity granted to them through CDA 230, then sometimes the question becomes, how do you incentivize these companies to take things like non-consensual pornography seriously? Because in many cases, they don't.
Right. Well, that's a great avenue to get into the discussion I alluded to earlier, state versus federal law. Right now, we don't have a federal criminal landscape for this kind of situations we're discussing here, but many lawmakers would like to change that. Can you tell us where things stand?
Yes. So I've been working with a few members of Congress for some time. It's been taking us quite a long time to try to get this right on developing a federal criminal bill against non-consensual pornography that is tentatively titled the Intimate Privacy Protection Act. And essentially what that act would do would be to state that the non-consensual distribution of sexually explicit private photos or videos would be against the law. And if that's the case, then of course, that would apply to any place within U.S. jurisdiction, and it would not necessarily mean that an intermediary could simply get out of liability by saying, well, I'm just a host, because if it's a violation of federal criminal law, there's at least a question about whether the host might be in some ways responsible for that.
Right. So where actually procedurally do things stand with that law?
Well, the law was intended to be introduced over the summer, and one of the delays was caused by the fact that we were really trying to get as much feedback from the major tech companies as we could. We would like them to be partners in this bill as opposed to people who would be upset by the bill. So we've been taking as much time as we need to try to make sure that we're in conversation with civil liberties groups, with tech companies, with ISPs, to make a bill where all the right things get put into place and none of the wrong things. So we're trying to make sure that we craft a bill that comprehensively protects victims while still honoring the First Amendment, of course, and while still honoring the ability of intermediaries to deal with the massive amounts of content that they have. So we are still in a good position with the bill. We think we found the final or near final draft. I don't know exactly when it's going to be introduced because there's a lot of things going on in Congress right now. So it's always hard to predict when exactly they're going to bring it forward, but we're hoping before too long.
And is it still Representative Jackie Speier?
Jackie Speier, yes. She's the one who is sponsoring the legislation, and we'll have other sponsors as well when we announce and introduce.
Alex, do you think that a federal law that gives all companies in all states guidance on this would be helpful instead of having every in-house counsel and outside law firm have to know the laws of all the 50 states in which the company might do business?
Well, that's always preferable. It really depends on the approach taken. you know, obviously, websites would probably prefer to have the outright immunity on a federal level, but you know, if that's not, and I could see certainly why proponents of the legislation wouldn't want that. So, I mean, I think that. That you know, an approach like a notice and takedown, like we have with the DMCA, or something that allows websites to receive notice and deal with the issue accordingly, would probably work and would probably be a helpful regime.
What do you think about that kind of approach, Marianne? You wrote about that a bit in talking about the new complaint form that Pornhub has put up. Can you tell us about that and how taking down works in practice?
Sure. Alex's points are very well taken. Part of what we want to ensure is that we're not creating just massive liability to these companies that have to deal with so much content. We don't want to make them responsible directly for content that's provided by third parties. So the way that our recommendation, at least in terms of crafting the provision for companies, is to have a separate treatment for companies as opposed to individuals, and that we would say for companies that they can't be liable unless they knowingly promote or solicit content that they know is in violation of the particular federal law. So that would really cabin and restrict it to websites that are really trafficking in this type of material and not Google that may be inadvertently collecting some of this material. But any of the companies that are taking steps to try to allow for removals is facing the same problem. What do you do about your processes after the fact? Because you have to set up a reporting process that's going to be easy enough for victims to navigate and hopefully not re-traumatize them in the process. You have to figure out how are you going to verify that the person who is making the complaint is in fact the person who's in the video or the photo. You have to find a way to verify that this is in fact a non-consensually distributed form of content as opposed to one that was consensually distributed. And then you have to figure out how can you get all of this done in a timely fashion, because for victims of this practice, every minute really does count. One of the critiques that I made of Pornhub's new policy, which is not that different from many of the other companies' policies, is that it's wonderful that they're allowing for a takedown form, that someone can make a complaint and say, this is being used without my permission. The problem with all of these approaches, though, is that they happen after the fact. If an image goes viral, it can do so in a few minutes. So even if somebody finds out, say, a week later that they are, in fact, on Pornhub somewhere, by the time they make the complaint, by the time it's investigated, by the time that it's been taken down, there could have been thousands of shares and downloadings and forwardings and uploadings. And so that's not going to be that helpful to victims. So what we at CCRI have been trying to advocate for are for companies to think creatively about preemptive measures. Pornhub said it characterized its removal form as a preemptive strike against revenge porn, and many of the activists that I work with take issue with that because it isn't a preemptive strike. It's very much a after the fact we'll try to help you, which is laudable. But a truly preemptive strike would be for these companies that deal with adult material to try to put steps in place to ensure that the material that they distribute is in fact consensual before they allow it to be distributed. And a couple of the ways that I have suggested that they could do that is through pop-up boxes suggesting, reminding people that non-consensual pornography is now a crime in the majority of U.S. states. We're at 26 states now. And asking them to verify that they have had the permission of everybody in that photo or video before they upload it. It obviously can't stop everybody, and people can lie, but at least those would be something like deterrent measures to keep that non-consensual pornography from ever being distributed in the first place.
Right, because when you're dealing with a site that's actually, you know, in the business of offering pornography online, and that's legal and that's their business model, a simple filtering for that sort of material isn't going to do them any good at all, is it?
If you mean by the after the fact, it's really not going to help them very much after the fact, because yes, the nature of these images is that they can become very popular very quickly. And what we also have to remember about many people who are victimized by this conduct, they don't know about it right away. Very often it'll be the case that they will find out that their video or their picture has been up on a site for 6 months. And once they find that out, maybe they can go through the process of getting it taken down from that site, but that doesn't mean that they can do anything about the hundreds of other sites that their image has now been republished and forwarded to.
Right. No, I was more thinking of the example that Alex raised earlier, that YouTube and Facebook is going to screen in advance I believe, and Alex, correct me if I'm wrong, that there is some sort of screening that goes on instead of just relying on the community. Although I could be wrong on that. As far as explicit material getting posted to the site, it may be up for a short amount of time before it's caught and pulled down. Do you know for a fact whether, you know, I know when I upload something to YouTube, it seems to get posted pretty immediately.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what they whether they've implemented technological measures yet. Mm-hmm. I believe they are certainly working on it. I mean, they are developing algorithms to determine the level of nudity in a picture so that a computer can do that. I mean, just the fact that if you go through YouTube, I've yet to see anything pornographic on YouTube. Not that I'm looking, but, you know, they seem to be doing a good job of ensuring that none of it gets through, and I've yet to see any kind of pornographic pictures distributed over Facebook either. And in fact, you know, there's been news reports of breastfeeding images have been automatically removed by Facebook. So they're doing something. I certainly don't work with either of those two companies, so I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly what they're doing, but it's clear they're doing something, and it's clear there's a lot of research and development going forward, either by these companies or by companies that are looking to license their technology to these companies, to really create the mechanisms by which the computers can use artificial intelligence to identify these images. But I would say, you know, there are websites out there where the goal is not to eliminate you know, pornographic images, like Pornhub or any of these sites. So for them, the challenge is more significant, and I'm not sure a questionnaire is going to get there for anybody, whether it's for the victims or the companies, because, you know, I mean, if someone is of the type who would post this stuff online, they're probably going to lie on the questionnaire as well, you know, on their way to uploading it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it would at least be an incentive to slow your roll a bit, to think about the fact that there are criminal penalties that may attach to what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess letting them know that might be, you know, there's probably plenty of people who think, oh, I didn't know it was illegal to do that.
Right. So, Marianne, what I was getting at is that maybe some sites who just don't, you know, that's not their business model, having explicit material, and they have their own freedom of speech issues around that, the breastfeeding issue on Facebook that they've had to go back and forth on. But, you know, so filtering is a good tool for helping exploitation stay off sites too. But many sites just, you know, you can't filter if you're a Pornhub. You want the explicit material on your site.
Right. That's why the filters, I do think that they're gaining quite a lot in sophistication about being able to tell based on skin tones and things like that, whether something's a sexually explicit photo. And that is going to be useful for platforms that have a no pornography stance. But I should say that the point about Facebook and breastfeeding points out how difficult that is. We might think that the judgment of something being sexually explicit is one that an algorithm can make, but how do you really decide whether a breastfeeding photo is different from a topless, another type of topless photo, if all you're basing this on is whether or not there's a nipple on the screen? So these are all value judgments that I think we have to confront, in the sense that we have to decide whether that's the kind of content we want or not. And on Facebook, unfortunately, yes, sometimes breastfeeding photos get taken down, but sadly, we've heard from many victims who have had explicit photos of themselves up on the site under fake profiles for many, many months before Facebook did anything. So part of the frustration on the part of many users is, how is it that you can respond so quickly to breastfeeding photos, but that you can hear complaints for months about non-consensual pornography and do nothing? That being said, I know that Facebook, I've worked with them in the past as well, they are making serious efforts recently to try to implement very effective, streamlined policies for people to report so that they can get at this content sooner. Of course, what we understand from Facebook and all these other very popular platforms is that they're dealing with so much content. So it's not going to be as though they could snap their fingers and say, well, this is what we're going to do. But I do think that the idea of preemptive measures, they obviously can't focus on just is it naked people or is it not naked people, because that's not really going to help, as you say, when it comes to adult sites, and it may not be answering the question we really should answer anyway. But letting people know, first of all, that something's criminal activity, I do think is a deterrent in many cases. But secondly, companies themselves can impose punishments that would matter to these users. If Pornhub tells you, if we find out that you have lied about this content, then we can ban you from the site, or we can at least make it complicated for you to be here. Twitter has been trying all kinds of interesting policies lately about essentially penalizing users who violate the terms and conditions. And that's it's the educational aspect of all of this, I think, is what's most important. We learn our norms from technology. We learn our norms from what people are allowed to do on the internet and what they get validated for and what they get criticized for. So if the company itself is making strong claims about the kinds of things that are acceptable and not, and at least imposing some sort of penalties and some sort of informational practices geared towards that, I think that can have a really, really big effect. Because the real question is, why do people engage in this behavior? Why do people post pictures of other people without their consent? Why is there an entire niche industry of consumers who are looking for revenge porn, that's what they're searching for? Out of all the naked pictures you could see online, why are you looking for the ones that were taken or distributed without consent? That's a psychological question and a cultural question and a social question, and our technology has a lot to answer for that it has helped develop that type of norm.
Is that it is a complicated and fascinating psychological and social question. Is it one that the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative has tried to pin down an answer to?
We are definitely trying. We try to get as much information as we can from the victims who contact us about the circumstances of why this happened. We do as much research as we're able to. Unfortunately, we don't have funding, so we're all doing this on a voluntary basis. But trying to figure out both the circumstances under which victims contact us, but also trying to get at perpetrators' motivations and why it is that this is something that happens at all. And some of it is unfortunately quite predictable and obvious, that so much of non-consensual pornography tracks other forms of domestic violence and sexism. That is, a woman does something that a man doesn't like, and his way of responding is to create some sort of, in this case, not rumor, but image, some record of her sexuality. And that's enough to destroy her career and possibly her intimate relationships and possibly her future. So that's the model. There again, raising all these questions about why sexuality is being used as punishment, why people enjoy doing that, and why they think it's an acceptable way to respond to the end of a relationship or to a person not giving you the attention that you think you deserve. How it has become an acceptable way to deal with that by publishing private images, I think, is a depressing question.
Yeah, it is.
Hey, I had a question for Marianne. I'm kind of curious. Do we have any sense from your research in talking to perpetrators whether they have knowledge of the fact that A, it's illegal, and B, would they have not done things differently had they known it's illegal?
I think that's a really great question. And it's hard for us to know, because before we started our work in 2011, we were looking at only three states that had laws against non-consensual pornography. And those three states, nobody knew that there were laws there. So really no one ever thought it was a crime. So now we're in this really rapid era of states passing laws, and that's happened really quickly. There's been 23 states that have passed in the last 2 years. So it's hard for us to know what effect that's having, because it's still not clear whether the people in those states know that it's become a crime, and it's still not clear if that's going to change their behavior. What we do know, though, from isolated cases is that there were cases in some states where the perpetrator actually said to the victim, I'm going to do this because I think it was in Wisconsin, I think was where I was working on one of the earliest bills. The perpetrator said to the victim, I'm going to do this to you because I know that a law has been passed that makes this illegal, but it doesn't go into effect until whatever date he thought. And as it turned out, he was wrong. It had actually gone into effect the week before. So this was interesting. This was a perpetrator who was very transparent about the fact that he was going to do it because he thought it wasn't illegal. And as it turned out, in this case, it was in fact illegal, and he was prosecuted for that.
All right. Well, this seems like a good opportunity to explore the changing world of revenge porn and how the circumstance of the disgruntled former partner is shifting. And there are various other kinds of exploitation that are falling into this non-consensual pornography realm, and also to, in a moment, talk about two additional laws that California is considering putting on its books. But before we get to that, I'd like to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Blue Apron. Blue Apron is absolutely wonderful. I've used it myself. I send it to my mother on a frequent basis. It is gourmet food delivered to your home in an easy to prepare way that's not only saving you trips to the grocery store, but making sure that your family is eating healthy and deliciously, and possibly helping the main chef in your house out in the kitchen more than that person might get, because not only are the meals a great value, but they are quick to prepare, and everything that you need to put together a delicious meal is right there for you with easy step-by-step instructions. Now, here's what Blue Apron does. You go on their site, you sign up, you select how many meals that you would like delivered to your home on a weekly basis. You don't have to have them delivered every week. I find that getting this once or twice a month is usually fine for our family, and it's very easy to customize how much you're receiving and how often you receive it. And actually, they've just recently updated their site to make it so that after you've put in certain dietary preferences, they try and guess, you know, what you'll like each week based on what you've told them. If you're a meat person or no shellfish or vegan, whatever, you know, is your particular thing, they will cater to that. But if you see that in a particular week they have more meals that you'd like to try that don't fit into those parameters, you can customize. You can change what's getting delivered to your house. So that's new and fun. And then when it comes right to your door, it's fresh as can be and ready to cook. And each meal costs less than $10. They send you the fresh ingredients. Everything's perfectly proportioned. You get these beautiful recipe cards that tell you in a very straightforward way that doesn't assume that you've been to cooking school, how to put everything together. You've got pictures of steps along the way, so you know what it's supposed to look like when you're chopping or sauteing or whatever step you're at. And it saves you the trip to the grocery store. And that is probably my favorite thing about Blue Apron, is just how convenient it is. And you don't wind up with things sitting in your refrigerator going unused because you bought too much or you just never got around to making that. It's perfect for date night, cooking with friends. They even offer family plans with kid-friendly ingredients so the whole family can eat well and have fun preparing meals together. Each meal is between 500 and 700 calories per serving. So yummy, you'd never know that. Cooking takes about half an hour to 45 minutes, depending on the prep time. Shipping is free, and the menus are always new. They won't send you the same meal twice. They work around your schedule and your dietary preferences. And Blue Apron's experts source only the best seasonal ingredients for incredible meals, like Southern-style burgers with green tomato chow chow and Old Bay oven fries, or kale and Monterey Jack quesadillas and avocado, radishes, and fried eggs. You'll cook these incredible meals and be blown away by the quality and freshness. I know Stefan Kinsella, who's been a guest on our show several times and listens to the show, I hope, even when he's not a guest, recently made a meal that he let me know about, and he just loved it. He made one of the fish dishes. So I encourage you to do what Stefan did and try it out for yourself. You're going to do that by going to blueapron.com/twit, and you'll get two free meals just for doing that. blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's talk about revenge porn versus cyber exploitation. How are things changing in the way these images are being used, Marianne?
Do you mean the differences between the terms or the way that we're approaching the problem?
I guess I mean the way that revenge porn just isn't a sufficiently broad term anymore to capture the way that people are being exploited by non-consensual use of intimate photos or videos.
Right. So this was always a difficult thing to navigate for victims, because it's true that revenge porn is an incredibly misleading and really quite offensive term. And a lot of victims take issue with it. A lot of activists take issue with it, partly because it seems to create the impression that this is always a personal relationship that has gone bad somehow. It also seems to imply that this is that revenge is something that's acceptable to undertake if a relationship has ended. What it doesn't capture, something that we have at CSRI have emphasized, is that it doesn't capture the fact that the real issue is the lack of consent, not the motive of the perpetrator, because it could be that he's an angry ex-boyfriend. It could also be that he's the hacker who has found it lucrative or possibly just entertaining to hack into celebrities' private accounts and to get their pictures. It could be that it's a California Highway Patrol officer who has arrested a woman for a DUI and has taken her phone, found some sexually explicit pictures, and forwarded them to his fellow officers because he thought it was funny to do so. That all these things and sexual assaults that occur at fraternity parties that are recorded and then distributed as entertainment, none of that is really captured by the term revenge porn. So at CCRI, we have more or less landed on the term non-consensual pornography to emphasize the fact that these are images used without consent. The pornography part is still very controversial, but it seems important to designate exactly what we're talking about. We're not talking about unflattering photos. We're not talking about stories you could write about somebody. We're really talking about images that people are using as pornography, that they have turned it into pornography, even though it was not intended to be. California has decided to go with cyber exploitation, and that has other benefits. It does move away from this very loaded term of pornography and focuses on the fact that this is exploitation. The trouble with the term a little bit is that people don't necessarily know what is meant by cyber exploitation when they hear the term, because it could mean so many different things. And one thing that I think is important to point out is that, of course, non-consensual pornography, the publication of these images and videos, does not necessarily have to take place in cyberspace, right? It isn't just an internet phenomenon. We have plenty of cases where the perpetrator has actually printed out DVDs, he's printed out actual photos, or he's made copies of DVDs of this material and put them all over a victim's neighborhood. So mm-hmm. I think it's really important not to restrict ourselves to the technology part of it, because it can happen in some very low-tech ways.
So one of the interesting things California is considering doing, there are a couple of new laws that California is mulling. One of them would allow California lawyers to prosecute the would-be defendants in California, wherever those defendants may be. Could you speak to that approach for a moment, Marianne?
Well, this is something that every state, well, not just every state, every place has to deal with in light of the internet. The jurisdictional questions that are posed by the internet are very complex. It used to be the case that you could more easily figure out where the fair place was for a person to be brought to trial, because it had to do with where he was or where the contact took place. Now that you have the internet and the fact that it doesn't exist necessarily in a specific geographical area, it raises all kinds of questions about jurisdiction. So you can take the approach of California to say that, or not just of California, there's different ways that states can say, well, you're subject to our jurisdiction if you live here, but also if maybe your victim lives here, even if you don't, or maybe even if you don't live here and the victim doesn't live here, but someone in California, let's say, viewed this image here. So that is to say, part of the crime took place in California, maybe that gives us jurisdiction. And then there's a separate question of saying what usually that entails, which is if California has jurisdiction, that means you have to show up in California and defend yourself. So it does raise some questions about due process and fairness to the defendant, because it's obviously inconvenient in many cases for someone to have to travel to a state where they don't live to defend themselves. So it does raise questions about jurisdiction there. But it also points up to the fact that now that the internet exists, there are so many ways to harm people that are not restricted by anything like physical boundaries. And California is making an attempt to figure out the best way to approach the fact that there are no longer physical boundaries to this type of harm.
Have any of the other 26, or I guess 25, excluding California, states taken this approach?
There have been several states that have explicitly included long-arm jurisdiction sections in their statutes, which state things like, this will apply to any perpetrator who lives in this state, it will apply if the victim lives in the state or if the transmission was viewed in the state. So different states have taken different measures. Some of them haven't made any explicit claims about jurisdiction within the, if we want to call it that, the specific revenge porn law, but would be dealt with elsewhere in the state code. So states have already made decisions before they ever come to the revenge porn issue about where the jurisdiction will fall. So we might see challenges on those bases as well, but states have taken a variety of approaches to the jurisdiction question.
Right. I'm not a criminal lawyer, and I know you're not either, Alex, but I think it's probably pretty unusual for there to be criminal statutes where the defendant, the person being prosecuted, would actually be removed from where they live and made to face trial in another state. Do you agree?
I don't know if that in and of itself is unusual. Obviously, of course, the state in where the defendant lives can prosecute the defendant. Mm-hmm. The next step is, you know, if the victim is in that other state, is there jurisdiction? And there's at least some some types of jurisdiction where, you know, if the effect is felt in another state, and the defendant knew about that they can assert jurisdiction, a claim that if the image is viewed in a state when the entire internet is viewable in any state, to me seems a little tenuous. And I mean, you know, look, I don't do litigation, so I don't deal with jurisdictional issues in my day job, but it just seems to me that might be a little of a bit of a bridge too far.
And if we get a federal law, obviously that will help this situation. The federal law would apply in all of the states. The other thing that California is considering doing is enacting a law that would give law enforcement better processes for seizing and destroying these kinds of images. Have you looked at that, Marianne?
Yes. And again, we've seen several states do something similar, that within the criminal statutes, they've created provisions that have to do with relief for the victim, including things like destruction of the image. Now, that, again, raises several questions about how will that work? So in theory, it sounds like it makes a lot of sense. This is the harmful material that is evidence of a crime. You can ask people to destroy that. But when we're talking about now an image that's been uploaded onto 25 other places, what does it mean to destroy an image? But I think it is a good sign that states are thinking about this, because the harm in this case, you know, in this type of conduct, really is the existence of the image. So it's not so much about putting a perpetrator in jail as it is about trying to undo the harm to the extent that that's possible after the fact. And so it's quite important to at least create the space for these types of remedies, that you can call for the destruction of this material.
Right. I would assume that even under existing law, law enforcement has some sort of power to, you know, as you were saying, if something has been more widely distributed than just one site, that a prosecutor could now go and instruct people to take that down? Or do they actually need a legislative authority to give them that power?
This is the really complex question that Alex was raising before, about the obligations of these sites under the mm-hmm. Communications Decency Act Section 230. Because if you want to say to the defendant, as part of your conviction, you have to delete these images, that's one thing, and that's not necessarily that complicated. But mm-hmm. now if you're saying, well, these images have been uploaded to these four other sites, who's in control of destroying those images? Not the defendant. It's out of his hands at that point. So you'd be looking at law enforcement trying to tell, for instance, Pornhub, you have to destroy this image. On what mm-hmm. basis can they say you have to destroy this image? If I were a lawyer for Pornhub, I'd say, well, Section 230 tells me I don't have to destroy the image because I'm not responsible for violations that either that arise in tort or in state criminal law. So you really can't mm-hmm. touch me. Now, again, there would be something different if this were a federal criminal bill that we were talking about instead, which is why child pornography works differently, because that is, in fact, a federal criminal offense, and therefore you don't have websites saying, I'm not responsible for the child porn on my site. Well, they are, because it's actually in violation of federal law. But as long as we're talking about merely a state law, the intermediary in this case would say, you don't have any power to tell me to destroy material on my site.
Right. So it sounds like this California law is a good step toward making sure that material like this, if it has spread, has a good opportunity of coming down.
Well, I don't know what the particular mechanics of the California law would be on this one, because it raises a lot of questions about how you'd execute these types of orders. And I don't know if it's necessarily, we could say that it's a good thing if we're looking purely from the perspective of for the victim to have these types of material removed. Yes, that's a good thing. From the perspective of the Section 230 protections that we do think are good, at least in general, for a lot of these sites, that may not be a good thing.
Okay, so that'll be one to watch, and it's one that Kamala Harris in California has put forth as part of the greater ending cyber exploitation initiative she announced this week. Is there anything else on this topic? Obviously, you know, we could talk about this topic all day, but we have a few more things to get to in our show today. Before we wrap up, Marianne, is there anything else you think that's particularly urgent and pressing that people should know?
Well, I think just on this subject, I do think it's already happening, and we've made reference to it already in this conversation, but that the important shift, I think, in the public's imagination about this is having to do with privacy, that this is not just a matter of what we want to call voyeurism or a form of a kind of, in some cases at least, a theft of property, but actually as a privacy violation, that if we understand on an intuitive level why it is that people cannot just take private information of ours and distribute it widely, even if we have voluntarily given them that private information. And that's everything from giving your credit card to a waiter to giving your spouse access to your social security number, that doesn't authorize any of those parties to then take that information and make it widely available. That the resistance that we've seen in some states and by some civil liberties groups to say that this violates the First Amendment, I think we really do need to remind ourselves that privacy protections are not violations of the First Amendment. They are, in fact, the way that we keep some of our First Amendment rights from being trampled upon. That without privacy, we do not have freedom of speech. We do not have liberty if we don't have privacy. So that I think that this is the message that's starting to seep through, that if we truly care about freedom of expression, if we truly care about privacy, then we have to care about sexual information as much as we care about other forms of information.
Yes, excellent point. One thing we haven't talked about in this discussion, or we touched on it, but without going into great detail, is the fact that in some instances, intellectual property laws have been used as a vehicle to get things taken down, which would apply if the subject of the picture also took the picture in selfie style. Do you think that any of the laws, both at the federal level and the state level that we've discussed today, are designed to provide remedies without having to bring IP law into this?
That's certainly part of it. Part of it is just the inherent limitation, as you made reference to, is that you had to have taken the image yourself. And in a lot of these cases, they haven't. It's someone else has taken the picture of them. So that means that from the very beginning, copyright's a non-starter for them. The second problem with copyright is that many, many sites completely ignore takedown requests. That if they're in the business of publishing images without people's consent, and they know that this threatening letter from you saying you should take this down, it's my copyrighted image, they know that you're not actually going to bring a suit. You probably don't have the means to do so. So they will just take the chance and leave it up anyway. So it's not a very effective remedy, even for those people who can take it. And then the third objection would be that it's just not the right fit. That's not what intellectual property law is designed for. And to suggest that really the harm that has happened in cases of non-consensual pornography is merely that of property damage is something that many people would object to, that it's not about the fact that something has been stolen or misappropriated. It's about the fact that privacy has been invaded in a way that cannot actually be given a remedy after the fact. It has to not happen to begin with. It's the kind of breach that is unanswerable and needs to be treated much more like a kind of sense of abuse as opposed to a property offense.
Right. I guess a good thing to way to think about this is there are certain crimes you simply don't want to have happen, like murder. And the laws are designed to try and prevent those things from happening rather than simply punish them after the fact, which sadly we have to do as well.
Exactly. The emphasis is really on deterrence because by the time, no matter how good the solution afterwards, whether there are strong criminal penalties, whether there are copyright remedies, whether there's a civil process, by the time the image is out there, it's very, very difficult for the victim to take back any kind of control. And as soon as that image has been viewed, a violation has happened. And so one of the reasons that we agitate for criminal laws is because it seems to be the only effective, or at least potentially effective, deterrent for people who might otherwise engage in this behavior. People don't worry about getting sued, and they don't worry that at some point they might get a copyright letter. What they might worry about is the fact that they might end up in jail.
All right. Alex, any final thoughts on this?
Well, no. I mean, I think, Marianne, you're doing a great thing. Thank you for your work on this topic. And it's thankfully an issue that I don't have to deal with in my everyday practice. Most of my clients are not looking to have any pornographic images on their sites, let alone ones that invoke criminal liability. But I'm aware that it is a problem out there, and it's one that needs attention. So right. Thanks for your work on this.
Thank you.
All right. Before we leave our topic of things that involve video and crime, on a much more lighthearted note, except for perhaps in the case of the woman who carried out this incident. In Lakeland, Florida, I don't know how far that is from Miami, Marianne, but earlier this week, a woman decided it would be a good idea to have a few drinks, get in her car, start using Periscope, and film herself, live stream herself driving around under the influence. And lo and behold, that video did exactly what it should have done. It triggered law enforcement getting involved and having her saddled with a DUI. So here we have an episode of simply oversharing and bad judgment and, you know, maybe a little bit of social service here to spread the word that, you know, videoing yourself drunk, yes, will have it, and driving around will have bad criminal repercussions for you. Any thoughts on this, Alex?
You know, there's going to be always someone who uses technology in a new way that we never anticipated. But I think that the police here were certainly glad she did. And, you know, sometimes technology helps criminals block investigations and hide their tracks. And in this case, it did just the opposite. But, I doubt whether we're going to see this as being a trend out there.
Yes. I don't know when the Darwin Awards are announced, but I definitely think this woman should be in the running. Any thoughts, Marianne?
I think it's one of these stories that tells you just how far the obsession with making a spectacle of oneself, the idea that anything we're doing that we think is even remotely interesting is something we should capture and distribute and tell everybody about, that's gone so far that something that is so clearly against one's own interests didn't even occur to this young woman that this might be a terrible idea. And so that I think it is something like a sad testament of just how much people want to provide entertainment for other people and not even think about what they're actually doing in the course of providing that entertainment.
All right. Well, we need to insert our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We put these in case you are watching or listening to the show in hope of receiving continuing legal or other professional credit in your jurisdiction. We put these phrases into the show so that you can demonstrate, if you have to, that you actually watched or listened. And our first phrase will be Darwin Winner of the Week in honor of drunk periscoping. All right. Let us move on to, we've already been talking about legislation and policy in the criminal context, but let's discuss some other policy issues. So we touched on the fact last week that the EU's recent safe harbor ruling is going to impact how U.S. companies move data around. This was a case involving someone in Ireland and whether his data could be moved to the U.S. from there. What we didn't talk about, and what Alex knows quite a bit about, is how this is going to affect you if you are a fledgling company dealing with people's data internationally. What is the impact, do you think, Alex, of this determination on the startup world?
Well, the honest truth is we don't know exactly what it's going to mean just yet, but whatever it is, it's probably going to be pretty significant. So this case was, I think, is very much a result of the Edwin Snowden controversy, in that it is a direct result of the eroded trust that the rest of the world has on the safety of your data in the U.S. from prying government eyes. So to sort of set up the overall context here, everybody's familiar when you go onto a website, you have these privacy policies that you read. And those are mandated by a couple of mechanisms. One, in that California, the largest state in the country, has laws regarding setting up privacy policies and disclosing. And in addition, the FTC has ruled somewhat indirectly that website operators do have an obligation to be honest and to disclose how information is collected, used, and given to third parties. With that said, the U.S. is privacy regime is very much a disclosure-based regime. It pretty much says you can do most things as long as you tell your users what you're doing. And so, you know, and then there are exceptions to that. There's financial data. There's a HIPAA for health data. But when you're talking about any old, you know, data, most of the time we're very much in a disclosure regime. The EU has a very different attitude towards this whole issue, and you know, essentially the way their privacy regulations work is that if you're going to collect data from your users and you're going to process that data in some way or make use of it, and I'm paraphrasing here very much, you really have to do it in the most minimally invasive way. The essential underlying assumption in the EU is you really shouldn't be collecting and utilizing people's data unless you really need to. And you know, they have provisions that require what are called data controllers, which is pretty wide, you know, which is pretty wide definition, must register with the EU, and as such, it's just a much more protective regime. And the other issue is if your company is doing business in the EU and you're collecting data, you can't just export that data to a country where they'd receive lesser protection, which would pretty much preclude any company from moving data, you know, that operates both in the EU and the US, from moving the data outside of the EU back to the US. So if the servers are located in the US or they want to make use of the information somehow in the US, they just can't just transfer it over. Well, this was going to be a big problem, and our U.S. Department of Commerce back in 2000 negotiated what I think was a very favorable deal for us, which was called the Safe Harbor, which allowed websites that operate in the U.S. and EU to essentially self-certify by making a filing in the U.S. that they will abide by certain principles. And these principles are, I'd say, a bit more protective of what the minimum required is of the U.S., but not nearly as onerous as what you'll see in the EU. Well, you know, that's been relied on. I think there are currently around 4,500 companies that rely on this. You know, it is public information as to who is registered. And, you know, it's the FTC that does all the enforcement of this safe harbor rather than the EU. So you're dealing with the FTC, which is a lot easier to deal with than dealing with the EU, especially if you're a US-based company, which is you want to deal with local regulators and, frankly, regulators that aren't nearly as active as those that are in the EU. Well, now that it's been invalidated, we don't really have a framework to deal with this issue. And at least in theory, that means that US-based companies that are subject to EU jurisdiction will now have to deal with EU privacy law. And it actually gets worse from there, because the EU is a conglomeration of multiple countries, and each country may have its own slightly different implementation of EU privacy regulations. So, you know, if you're operating in Germany, in the UK, in Ireland, and France, you know, you now may be dealing with multiple regulators, and this is going to be a, if nothing is done, this is going to be a difficult transition for companies. Now there is some. There's some possibility that this issue may get solved in that the U.S. and the EU were negotiating a new treaty or a new safe harbor, a revision to the old safe harbor that would have updated it. And this invalidation may cause the parties to put together something that is workable. The alternative is that this ruling, which is sort of the equivalent of a constitutional ruling here in the U.S., in that it's very difficult for the government to do something that is contrary to this ruling. At least that's my understanding of the inner workings of the EU here. So it may cause the negotiations of the Safe Harbor 2.0 to fall apart completely. So we really don't know exactly where it's going. We really don't know how quickly the individual privacy regulators are going to start enforcing their regulations on U.S. companies. If you're a small company, chances are you don't yet have a target on your back. If I were a Facebook or Google, I might worry a bit more, because the EU seems to be constantly taking action against Google, at least. So we really don't know where it's going. But depending on what the governments work out among each other and what they are able to work out, this may change how U.S. companies who have users in the EU are actually able to function there. And just a final point on this, you know, a lot of companies think that they're not subject to the EU, and the standard by which whether you're subject to the EU is whether you have equipment in the EU that collects and processes data on EU citizens. Now let's say you are a US-based company. You say, I have no servers in the EU. I have no equipment. Well, a lot of people interpret the word equipment to mean the user's computer. So of course the user, their computer is located in the UN. And so if you're storing cookies and collecting data that way, well, then you may actually be subject to EU jurisdiction. So generally when I'm working with startups that are in their early stages and really just can't even afford to deal with EU regulations, you know, I generally advise them to stick to the US for now in terms of their user base and not accept users in the EU.
Right. That's exactly what I was going to ask you if you thought would happen here. Because the parallel that I think of as I hear you discuss this and I read about this ruling is the way that companies have responded to COPPA in the United States. That's the Child Online Privacy Protection Act, which puts requirements on companies that are collecting data from children under the age of 13. And the restrictions are both, you know, what's not just the disclosure piece that Alex was discussing, but although that's a big part of it, you'd have to be very clear about what you're doing with the data. But there are also certain things you can do and you can't do under COPPA. So the way a lot of companies have dealt with that is just to say, no, that's not us. That's not our audience. They've, you know, even though there is some dispute and debate and gray area about whether people are actually collecting data from people under 13 or not, they try very hard not to be a COPPA-regulated company. And it strikes me that that's the tack that companies might take toward the EU. Can we ignore a whole, can companies ignore a whole region of the world and just not do business with them because the data laws are too extensive?
Well, it's a question of scaling. So when you're a very small company and you're just getting going, chances are what you're looking to do is validate your company's business model, probably through gaining users in the U.S. And probably that's sufficient to get them there. And as they're able to validate that business model and then able to get larger rounds of investment later, they then have the resources to hire EU compliance counsel. It is not disastrous in that I would even a very small company, I would probably advise, even before this happened, to restrict your users to the U.S. until you're able to afford to have that worldwide presence. The problem here is if nothing is done, then the sort of on-ramp to become an international website is now going to be steeper.
Right. As Marianne was pointing out earlier, it's in the age of the internet, it's hard to not be an international website. Do you think that that's practical, Marianne, for companies to restrict their users to the U.S.?
Well, I don't know if it's practical in a large sense. I mean, that, yes, we're living in an era where if you want to be successful, at least if you want to be successful in online terms, then you really do have to be successful in online terms, which means not restricting things according to physical boundaries. But at the same time, as much confusion as this decision is going to cause, it's necessary confusion. This is an important question for companies and for citizens to ask themselves. Google now, let's just take Google as an example, is not an American company in any kind of real sense. It's now a global company. It has global domination. And if it wants that global domination, it can't do what it has done for, I think, a long time, which is to basically use U.S. defaults about the First Amendment, about privacy, about anything, because it's no longer playing in just one backyard. So this is the responsibility of companies with all this, you know, this potential that you now have to become global, with all this potential you now have to tie all of us all around the world together in certain ways, tied by our data, then we really do need to have something like universal standards, because it's going to be, as a practical matter, so difficult to disentangle one country's data from another country's data. So as much of a mess as all of this is, I think it's a necessary mess to confront as quickly as possible and as effectively as possible, because we are now in a world where all of our different values, norms, and laws are clashing with each other to some extent, and we do need to work out what it's going to mean at a minimum for everybody that we want to do business with.
I really liked the way you put forth the proposition, Alex, of the U.S. being driven by disclosure and the EU being driven by what you actually are or are not allowed to do. Marianne, what do you think of that distinction? Is it that the EU has decided that you can give all the disclosure that you want, but it's not really effective? People don't read these things, and it doesn't really accomplish your goal.
Yes, I think that that's right. And a lot of scholarship and a lot of studies have actually borne this out, that disclosures are basically meaningless. People don't read the things that Apple tells us. People don't read their credit card instructions. This is the idea of disclosure in the U.S., and I think Alex is exactly right, this is how we do things in the U.S. This, we dump all this information on people, and they sign it, and then we say, well, you've consented. That's an incredibly artificial, formalistic notion of consent, because, of course, people don't know what they're signing on to, and they're never going to be able to take the time to actually understand the terms that they're signing on to. So as a culture, as a nation, you can have your default set at we're going to presume that everything is fine until you go out of your way to tell us that it's not. Or you could set the default in the other direction, which is we don't assume that it's fine unless you give us permission. And I think, you know, to tie this in a little bit with the privacy discussion in a more large sense, including things like non-consensual pornography, that really is the cultural psychological issue, which is, should we be, as a general matter, treating other human beings as though we're entitled to do whatever we want to with them unless they tell us no? Or should we, as a general matter, not assume that we can do things with other people and their data unless they tell us that we can? So it really is this question of whether or not we want to ask for permission or whether we want to ask for forgiveness. And it seems very often that the U.S. has chosen, we'll worry about it on the other end. And when it comes to sensitive privacy disclosures, so not things that you can change and not things that you can get damages in a financial sense back from, this is really the hard question. Because once that breach or that violation happens, we're really talking about situations that can't be undone. So at least for those situations, there's a very compelling case to say we need to shift our cultural norms about consent here. It needs to be affirmatively saying that there is consent, as opposed to, well, I just assumed everything was fine until you said no.
Mm-hmm. Alex, do you agree that in the U.S. We're overstepping by making assumptions about what we can do with the data until we're told no? Or that people should be required to read and be aware of companies' policies and be a lot more savvy about what's happening with their data?
Well, that's a good question. So, yep. I mean, I'll tell you personally. You know, I'm sure all of us on this podcast have agreed to many, many, many of those terms of use contracts and are subject to many, many privacy policies. And generally, it's not something I've worried about for myself personally. You know, if Google wants to use what I search for to serve up ads that are more relevant to me, you know, in my view, hey, I'm getting ads that are, I'm getting less irrelevant ads. So that may be a good thing. So, and I realize that my view on that is not how other people necessarily feel. But with a disclosure regime, you do give the ability of people who care about this thing, this issue, the ability to read about it and find out more about it and protect themselves. And the honest truth is, I think that the reality is most people don't care about the level of data collection that is going on. There's a lot of people who are concerned about the policy implications of all this and talk about it a lot, like people like us, and who are you know, this is, you know, we view this importantly. But I think most users of these sites, what they're giving up is, hey, I'm giving up some of my personal information, maybe not my most intimate information, but I'm giving up some of my personal information. In exchange, I'm getting this free stuff, you know, a free search engine, a free social media site, a free, you know, the old expression, if you're not paying for the product, then you are the product. And that is that pervades the internet. And, you know, I personally don't want to give that up. I kind of like it. And if you move away from a disclosure regime, you may not have the level of services and technology and innovation that our economy is providing. I mean, it's no surprise that most of the tech company and the innovation that is going on in the world is still in the U.S. It's not in the EU. And, you know, just take something like the right to be forgotten. You know, I heard one, you know, and he works, one counsel at Google once said, I thought this was a great quote. He's like, yeah, this is expensive for us to enforce, but in some ways, I know we're never going to get a European-based competitor to us, because the costs for them to comply with this rule is probably going to prevent other competitors in Europe from springing up. So, you know, the big guys like Google and Facebook, they'll be able to adapt to this no matter what happens. You know, the small guys here will just fly under the radar. It's the companies that are growing up above that small size and are now becoming medium size and need to make that jump to a worldwide audience, they're going to find that jump, that transition, to be more difficult now. And I don't know if that's a good thing.
Right. It's a really hard issue to grapple with, trying to decide whether the EU approach is better or the US approach is better. I think, you know, both are playing out in real time to see which experiment works better for the countries and their citizens. But the one thing that occurs to me from what you were just saying, Alex, is that, well, if it's all about market forces and you're getting services for free, then the logical thing to do would be to offer the ability to pay your way out of having your data collected and used, which then deepens the digital divide, right? There are people who will be able to or are willing to pay for that kind of protection, and others who simply won't receive it if they're not in that situation. And that doesn't seem like a good place to land up either. Do you agree?
Well, you know, it's also not all or nothing either. So, mm-hmm. you know, when we look at what privacy policies actually say in the US and then what privacy regulations in the EU regulate, it's not just, hey, I'm collecting your data so I can make money off of it, but I'm collecting your data to do things. I mean, just, you know, if the service, for instance, like Google Now, right, on mm-hmm. that's probably on a lot of our phones, which attempts to provide value for the customer by taking that customer's data, processing it, and doing things with it, and mm-hmm. and, you know, some of the value comes back to the user. It's not all just taking from the user, but when you're dealing with these regulations in Europe, the cost of doing things like that gets more expensive because you have to think through, okay, are we allowed to do this? Are we doing the minimum amount of processing that we need to do in order to get this feature going? And you know, is it a good thing that companies, you know, do the most minimally invasive thing? Yeah, it would be, but for them to face legal liability if they mess that up, you know, that imposes its own cost, and you know, we're talking about two different societies here. I mean, the U.S. has a much more laissez-faire view on this than Europe on business regulation in general, and this may just be one more reflection of that. Unfortunately, in most cases, you know, the U.S. can do its thing and the EU can do its own thing, and everybody's kind of happy because they're getting the kind of regulation they want or deserve. But in this instance, the parties kind of affect each other, and they're going to have to work this out.
Right. So we've been talking about all this in the context of websites and services available over the web, collecting data from users who are typing it in that kind of interface. I'm curious to get both of your takes on how this all shifts when it translates over to the Internet of Things. And the reason that this is on my mind is I just had a new refrigerator delivered yesterday, and it has a touchscreen. It's our first internet-enabled appliance. And it collects some data, not much. It basically just wants to be able to link up with certain services. I don't know who decided that a refrigerator should have the ability to play music at you via Pandora, but somebody at Samsung did. I kid you not, it's got tiny little speakers. They've got to be this big, right next to the water dispenser, and it dispenses not only water, but music if you ask it to. So it collects, you know, your account information for various things that you link up to. But there is no, you know, where do you do your disclosures when you are the appliance manufacturer? And how, you know, what sort of meaningful agreement are you having with your customers in that sort of situation? And goodness knows if they can sell these things in Europe or not, but at least, you know, going from what Alex was saying, here in the US, we have the disclosure regime that we're so used to with websites. There's no, as far as I could tell, there's no privacy policy I can click on my refrigerator. So I just wonder what you both think about that. We'll start with Marianne.
Well, I think even calling this the disclosure regime, I think we might want to go back to that for a minute and talk about whether companies are in fact really disclosing consequences to consumers. So it's one thing to say in a bunch of very convoluted language that we're collecting your data, et cetera, et cetera. It's another thing altogether to point out the fact that The danger oftentimes is not in the information you have released to one company. It's in the fact that that can be aggregated with the information you've released to 30 other companies. That it's that kind of digital aggregation that people are concerned about now. And that is not something that anybody is disclosing to the consumer. And so I think first we need to ask ourselves, if we're going to have a disclosure regime, and if we're going to put all the burden onto the consumer to be well informed about these issues, then there has to be some obligation on the part of the company to make that readable and comprehensible, and to actually outline the probable foreseeable consequences of not just this data collection, but where all of this is going to end up, including whether or not it's going to end up in the hands of the government, and which is why we're having a conversation about mass surveillance now. That, in addition to the fact that we need to care very much about the social reality that is, some of us may not care very much about the fact that our data is being aggregated, and that's probably because we have the luxury not to care, because we're not being targeted. I think if you were to ask many minority communities whether or not they care about their information being gathered in lots of incremental ways, in a way that builds up a digital dossier of them that could put them possibly in prison or could track them for the rest of their lives and everything that they do, everything from EBT cards, right, to any arrest mugshot that you might have ever had. Different people, according to their race, according to their gender, according to their class status, will be affected by this kind of privacy invading practices very differently than others. And I think it is important, or at least there's a case to be made, not to look to the fairly comfortable middle class's views on, do I care about my information being traded for convenience, to look at the bigger picture of the people who actually will suffer consequences, serious ones of these, and who are least able to either process the information that they're being told or to take preventative steps to make sure that their privacy remains secure. So I think if we're caught in the moment of saying, well, do I want to trade off my convenience, my privacy for convenience, we have to be sure that we're not treating our own culture as a monolith, because many people may be willing to make that trade-off partly because they have the luxury of doing so, and many other people may not want to, but are nonetheless pushed into a position of doing so because every decision that gets made, especially decisions made on a grand scale of big companies, will affect everybody's norms and expectations. So if middle class America says, I'm fine with my data being collected because I don't care about what they do with it, that's going to have repercussions for all of society, because that's how businesses and companies and society itself takes its standard. So we're going to be shifting the goalpost every time the people with the most resources make claims about what they care or don't care about with regard to privacy. And one argument would be, well, we really should be looking at what's going to happen to the people who are most vulnerable to privacy invasions and the uses of aggregated data, and start from there and use our policies around them so that we give everybody some baseline effect of privacy, if we care about that as an important social goal, which I think many people think it should be.
Yeah, excellent points, Marianne. Any response to that, Alex?
Well, you know, I think our one thing we haven't talked about is, while we are a disclosure regime, that's not always the case. There are certain areas of limited information where you have sensitive information, such as health information, like the HIPAA compliance rules, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley rules on financial information and Credit Reporting Act rules. So I think that the U.S. has taken an approach of, there are certain categories of use or information and the use of that information that does need to be more closely regulated, and perhaps we can deal with the issues of some of the more social and class-based issues in that, because usually the type of information that would affect these segments of the population are usually quite limited in what they are, and maybe we need a targeted approach. And it's certainly, I mean, I think Marianne makes a great point, and certainly, that's true, that the rules that affect me how the rules affect me may be very different from how they affect others in society. But I think, you brought up like mugshots and things like that. So things like criminal convictions or, any kind of, credit-based reporting information, health, all these different categories. You know, it might be worth reexamining how we deal with some of those.
Right. And meanwhile, in IRC, Omega Project has been building business models around the data collecting refrigerator, speculating that, you know, if you forked over your data, you would at least be expecting some free beer in return or some sort of a combination. Well, I mean, it's you folks remember People PC, no doubt, the PC that was free as long as you subjected yourselves to dozens of intrusive ads. And there, I have noticed there, I don't think these are ads that are coming from the manufacturer, but from the apps that run on the touchscreen on the fridge. Yes, now my fridge gives me ads, which I don't know that that's necessarily a great situation to be in. It was cheaper than many other refrigerators. So maybe I have People PC'd myself without even realizing it. All right. Before we leave these policy topics and the international arena, when we did the show last week, we had just learned that the final version of the TPP was going to get some congressional scrutiny and still didn't know. I think it might have been leaked that very day we did the show. But now the WikiLeaks draft dated October 5th has been out for a while, and the intellectual property chapter in particular has been scrutinized by folks who are, if this is indeed what the TPP will look like, are alarmed about the way that countries can require, further to our point here, turning over huge amounts of private data if they fear that someone is involved in an infringement or an alleged infringement. Marianne, have you had a chance to look at the leaked draft and any thoughts on the TPP?
I've only had a chance to look at it very, very quickly, so I wouldn't want to say too much about the details. But what you've sketched out, I mean, I think this is this larger concern about, and I think it's related to the conversation we've just been having, which is what are the expectations that, or I should say, the forces that would like to push towards greater transparency in the sense of gathering people's data, having access to all this information. This gets pushed in a certain direction, not only by business interests, but also by government interests. And I think one of the failings of the contemporary discourse about this is the failure to see that these two are often intertwined, that we still have a tendency to think of only being nervous about the state when the state looks as though it's doing something very state-like, as opposed to being concerned about what Google might be doing with the state and about the fact that a lot of these private companies are exactly the enforcers and the gatherers of the data that the state really is trying to get to. So I think all of this anxiety, the fact that the terms are written the way they are and the resulting anxiety are both products of the fact that we're in a culture that keeps pushing the boundaries of what is expected. What do you have to give up if you want X, Y, or Z? And we're pushing that farther and farther, essentially to this point of saying you have to give up everything if you want anything. And I think that it's no surprise that there is some outcry over that.
Right. It's difficult to talk about the PCC when, or I'm sorry, PCC, TPP, another three-letter acronym, until we know what the final draft actually says. I mean, who knows if the leaks are accurate or not. WikiLeaks has a pretty good track record of putting information out there. So, you know, I'm not terribly uncomfortable talking about it, but the actual official consideration of the TPP continues to happen behind closed doors. So this is one that, we're just trusting to our lawmakers. We'll have to see how well they do with it. Alex, any thoughts?
I didn't read the leaked document. My understanding from the coverage was that this provision in particular deals with when there is an infringement suit where the plaintiff is suing in country A, and the ISP in question is in country B, and it's obligating country B to enforce the discovery request demanding, you know, IP address and things like that. Is that your understanding of it, Denise?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's not exactly earth-shattering. I mean, currently, if you are sued for infringement, or probably you'd be sued as a John Doe here in the U.S., and you know, Comcast is your ISP, Comcast will have to turn over your identity. So this just broadens that out to a an international arena. You know, whatever your feelings are about whether we should be having ISPs turn over the identity of infringers probably is going to determine what your view is on whether that should happen also in an international suit.
Right. Hey, one area I wanted to cover with you, Alex, before we leave the arena of policy is the burgeoning startups that are taking place in the crowdfunding world, the ones that, you know, wouldn't be here if they weren't able to take to Kickstarter and Indiegogo and sell people on a product before it's even made. A few years down the road into this process now, we've seen, you know, as a lot of people thought would happen at the beginning, that there have been some really excellent products that have come out of that ecosystem, and some that have been either awful or just never delivered, or, you know, years down the road past their promised delivery date or not yet here. I'm just wondering what your take is on that ecosystem, and whether you think, in light of the fact that there is a lot of risk involved in funding companies this way, that kind of process may become more regulated.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, currently, if you're talking about donation-based crowdfunding, where someone goes on to Kickstarter, they're saying, I want to raise $50,000. Okay, and it's a pure donation. If you don't, but you know, when the product's done, I'll send you a free sample or something, or you'll get a T-shirt or whatever the free gift is. Right now, that's not very regulated, and there's not a lot of risk for the companies doing the crowdfunding raise there. There is the FTC, which will enforce their ability to go after misleading trade practices under the laws that they enforce, but the FTC just doesn't have the resources to really look into all of these raises. So right now, I mean, every now and then you hear about someone who got fined or whatever for engaging in a fraudulent Kickstarter offering, but there really isn't all that much enforcement, and there's really not a whole lot of risk to companies. Where the real policy action is you know, a lot of people want to raise money on the internet by offering equity in the company, and that has traditionally been illegal under U.S. securities laws. Now, there have been some changes that have allowed for a couple of crowdfunding-like things that really don't meet anywhere near the flexibility that, say, a Kickstarter raise has. But, you know, I still think we're years down the line in that area. And, you know, if it ever happens in any kind of real practical way, there's a lot of regulators out there who do not want to see that occur.
All right. Well, I think we'll do one final intellectual property and entertainment industry related story before we get to our tip of the week and resource of the week and wrap the show. We do need a final MCLE passphrase for the show, and let's make it people PC'd in honor of my glowing new refrigerator. Let's talk about the movie Steve Jobs briefly. I haven't seen it yet. It's definitely on my watch list. Need to get out to the theater, I think, and see this one before it comes out in other formats. But the thing that caught my eye this week that I thought was interesting is the fact that the iconic 1984 Apple ad that was aired during the 1984 Super Bowl is used in the film. And it sounds as though there was some back and forth between Universal, who made the movie, and Chiat Day, who made the ad, and also Steve Jobs' family was involved. That interested me. Who has the rights to this commercial down the road? Seems like an interesting question in its own right. But the upshot of Universal's contacts trying to get permission to use the ad in the film is they got shut out. Nobody wanted to give them permission to use the ad. The family of Steve Jobs was not real happy with the book, the biography that the movie is at least in part based on. So nobody gave them permission, and Universal's lawyers nevertheless decided, you know what? We can use this ad under fair use, and went through the fair use factors and decided that they were on solid ground. So as far as I know, they haven't been challenged on that yet, and the movie's in theaters now. And it's just interesting to have a big Hollywood studio like Universal take this approach to a piece of IP that's used in the movie. As a film documentary producer as well, Marianne, I'm wondering if you have an opinion on this.
Well, I haven't seen the movie either. So with that caveat, that fair use is a really important doctrine, not only for the purposes of copyright specifically, but just based on this principle that we do want to be able to have freedom of expression. We want to be able to discuss ideas. And if we hold copyright law too tightly, that would actually inhibit a lot of conversations, political and otherwise, that we could be having. When you have a movie about an iconic figure, a company that has made so much of an impact on culture, those are the kinds of things you have to consider in fair use. And it would be hard in some ways to tell the story of Steve Jobs without mentioning this commercial. So that's something I think one would have to take into consideration. And also, the people who are objecting to its use would have to show how they are being harmed by it. It would be difficult to make out a claim to say, well, if you use this commercial in your movie, that means that Apple won't sell as many products. That doesn't seem very likely. So it's not a straightforward case, like if someone takes your novel and publishes on the internet so that nobody actually goes and buys your book. So I think fair use is a really important concept. You want innovators and you want filmmakers and artists and singers to use the world as their art to some extent, not to steal it and not to profit from it in ways that would be unethical. But you do want there to be a wide variety of things that people can talk about, discuss, make parodies of, critique. And so I think it's probably right in this case that you should be able to use this commercial, considering the impact that this commercial had and how integrated it is with the history of the company, with the story that they're trying to tell in the movie.
Right. And again, not having seen the movie, I'm not sure how much of it was used, if it was used in its entirety. It does sound like it's not just gratuitously used in the movie at all, that there's quite a bit of the movie about the fact that the commercial was controversial and was going to air during the Super Bowl, and much back and forth about that fact. Alex, anything you want to add to this discussion?
Sure. Well, you know, first, it surprised me that it was the Steve Jobs family that had the rights to the ad, not Apple. But that's rather, you know, that's just a side point. I also agree that, you know, that this seemed to be like a clear example of where fair use would apply. But the thing that struck me the most was the fact that even though they didn't have the rights to use it, Universal, a corporate actor here, went ahead and did it anyway. And I think all too often, you know, when you're dealing with these movie studios and just the sort of the corporations that make these you know, movies and works and shows and all that, I think they're often way too timid on the issue of fair use, and often, you know, the policy seems to be, if we can't get the rights to it, we can't include it. And I just thought it was good to see see one of these movie studios take a stand on this issue.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating. All right, before we get to our tip and resource, we're going to give you another resource, our second sponsor of this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. If you're a freelancer or you own a small business, chances are that you don't have a big staff and you are personally responsible for getting those dollars into the door, and it's not very fun for you. Well, guess what? FreshBooks is exactly the solution that you need. You will no longer be rummaging through receipts and trying to keep track of your expenses. You will no longer need to worry about creating, formatting, and sending out your invoices. And you won't have to worry about tracking down customers who don't pay you on time, because FreshBooks takes care of all of that for you. It's the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of businesses like yours the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. I use FreshBooks in my law practice, and literally, I could not have my solo practice and get paid without the great services that FreshBooks provides. Because really, if I had to take time away from servicing my clients to take care of all these details, make sure that I'm accurately getting everything lined up and sent out in a timely manner, and following up with people who maybe have forgotten to pay an invoice, that's just way too much bandwidth away from the actual work I need to be doing. So FreshBooks makes it incredibly easy. I'm not a particularly great numbers person, but I don't have to worry about that as long as I'm accounting for my time. The invoices themselves take care of all of that. They look wonderful. They're professional. They are accurate. They are flexible. If you need to adjust, you know, how you're accounting for your time, accounting for what goes on the invoice, it's very customizable. You can organize your expenses easily. It's easy to track your time almost instantly, even on mobile devices. And with their automated late payment reminders that don't require you to pick up the phone or send out that email to remind a recalcitrant client, you avoid that awkward situation and just continue providing great service and getting paid for it. You'll wonder why you didn't start sooner. If you have questions, help is free forever, and you can always count on FreshBooks award-winning support rock stars to go above and beyond whenever you need a hand. Getting started is simple, and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to freshbooks.com/twill, and don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of this episode of This Week in Law. All right, we have a tip of the week for you. It's sort of a sad tip, but it's something to be aware of, that if you are, no matter how loyal a customer you are, no matter how many services you use of a particular company, here it was AT&T, and a man named Alfred Valery had some what he thought were good ideas for AT&T on how they could improve their services, and wrote to the CEO, Randall Stephenson, whose email address and other contact information is publicly available online, wrote a nice message making suggestions about services and data plans that should be available. He didn't think he'd hear anything back, and what he heard back instead was this very lawyerly letter. And our tip to you is that you shouldn't be surprised by such lawyerly letters, because companies are in the position oftentimes of getting sued by people who make suggestions and then never hear anything back. And then the company, lo and behold, months later, rolls out something that looks very like what the suggestion suggested. And so people, you know, it's sort of the bitch stole my look scenario. So companies do send back these letters that advise folks that they don't entertain unsolicited offers of business models or material or anything else to try and protect themselves from those kinds of suits. So the poor customer did not appreciate what happened. The Los Angeles Times wrote it up, as well as Ars Technica. We have the Ars Technica piece in our discussion points at Tag Packer. And actually, the CEO of AT&T, Randall Stephenson, did get back to the LA Times in the wake of all of this and admitted, hey, we blew it. This shouldn't have happened. We've already corrected it. But still, even though he said that, I'm sure the legal team is saying, no, wait, we send these out all the time and it's routine. So you shouldn't be surprised if your unsolicited suggestion to a company gets you met with some legalese in return. Our resources of the week are one for each guest this week. We have a wonderful series from Alexander at his law blog, which is called the Strictly Business Law Blog, part of his firm. He has this great and incredibly detailed 21-part VC term sheet negotiation resource. So if you are somebody who is thinking that venture capital money might be something in your future, you really have to go check this out. It walks you through the process in great detail. Alex, why did you decide to put this together?
Well, it's just such a daunting thing to occur in the lifestyle of a startup. I mean, you know, up to this point, they're probably dealing with very with investors that they may have a very close relationship with, where the documents might be very simple thus far. But once a VC term sheet comes in, and when I say a term sheet, the page size for these is, you know, often 15 pages. So it should be maybe term sheets. When one of those come in, they're very complicated. They involve concepts which the entrepreneur probably has never heard of in their life. So this is I wrote this to kind of give people just a sense of what all this stuff means, what they should be looking at, and how to think of these things through.
It's a really valuable resource for anybody who's thinking of starting a company and maybe going the VC route. And then also on my viewing list, right after I see Steve Jobs, or maybe before, because I can watch it at home on Netflix, I'm going to watch the film that Marianne co-produced. It's called Hot Girls Wanted. It's on Netflix. It was just recently made available there. It competed at Sundance earlier this year. And it's a documentary film about the amateur pornography industry. Can you tell us a bit more about it, Marianne?
Yes, it is, in fact, it's meant to give a look into an industry that I think is not often examined in this way. So, of course, pornography is extremely popular and people are consuming pornography at very high rates. And the so-called professional amateur industry is the type of pornography that's produced to look as though it's the girl next door, as though it isn't really high production studio quality. And it tends to focus on very, very young girls that is just turned 18. And the film focuses on the experiences of a group of women who have, most of whom have just turned 18 and who have responded to a Craigslist ad that if you are interested in becoming a porn star, we'll fly you to Miami and come see what it's like. And the film is meant to focus on just what it's like. What in fact, is it like to be someone trying to make it in the porn industry? What type of labor conditions can you expect? What type of money you're going to make? What kind of shelf life you're going to have, as it turns out, quite short? And what might be some of the issues with trying to either extricate yourself from the industry or to deal with some of the consequences you may not have anticipated when you first signed up? So it's meant to spotlight that very the very strange relationship I think that most people have with pornography, which is that, as I say, very popular to consume, but not that many people are concerned about the production conditions. So we have plenty of people who are concerned with where their chocolate comes from or where their T-shirts are made and whether conditions were fair and non-coercive, and asking a lot of questions about the quality of the production, whereas when it comes to pornography, certainly when it comes to the amateur porn industry, there doesn't seem to be very much concern over the health and welfare of the people working in that industry. And that's what the film was meant to highlight.
Had you ever been involved in producing a film before this?
Never before, no.
Yes, I'm sure this was a learning process, not just in making the film, but in being involved in making that happen. Congratulations that it got to Sundance. That's amazing for a documentary, a first effort documentary. Had your director made films before as well?
They have. The two filmmakers have actually made a previous documentary called Sexy Baby, which is also one that I would recommend that people have a look at. And mm-hmm. Hot Girls Wanted was also nominated for an Emmy. So that was also a very nice thing to happen.
Very cool. All right. Congratulations on both those fronts. Can't wait to see the movie. It sounds fascinating. And as has been our discussion here today, I've really enjoyed chatting with you both. I've learned a lot. I hope our audience has too. We do the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, when you can tune in and join us live. I'm always just so thrilled and grateful that the people that we invite on the show actually devote so much of their time to come and have these conversations with us every week. And this week has been no exception. Really wonderful insights and material that we've covered today. I really want to thank you, Alex, for coming along and giving us all your time and thoughtful comments today. Anything going on with your firm or your practice that you want to let people know about before we get on out of here?
No, nothing new. I'm still chugging along as I always do, but I guess I'll just plug my blog, which is down on the screen, but it's strictly businesslawblog.com. It's a resource for anyone who might be have a startup and they're interested in startup legal issues. It's just there for things that commonly asked questions or commonly encountered situations like getting your first VC term sheet. So it's there for the entrepreneur to learn, and if people have any kind of questions that they'd like me to address for a future article, I'm happy to take suggestions.
Thanks so much, Alex. Marianne, you've been back in school here for a few months into your fall term. I imagine you're probably starting to prep finals at this point. Am I right?
I put that off as long as I can. So not just yet, but probably very soon. That's true.
Yes. Anything else going on at the University of Miami School of Law or with the initiative, the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, that you think people should be aware of?
Yes, the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative is always looking for people who might want to volunteer with us. We have, as I mentioned before, we're taking a kind of three-pronged approach to the problem of abuses online. One is legislative reform, one is technological reform, and another is educational and social outreach. So we do things like provide a 24-hour helpline for victims. We recommend lawyers. We work with a legal group, the K&L Gates Law Firm, that has the Cyber Civil Rights Legal Project, which provides pro bono assistance to victims. So we're always looking for people who are interested in helping us with any of those projects. We're always interested in anybody who wants to help us get the funding that we need to continue doing the work that we're doing. To keep an eye out for the Intimate Privacy Protection Act, to write to their congresspeople about this, if this is an issue that's important to them. If you're in one of those states that does not yet have a non-consensual pornography law, to contact us if you'd like some help in getting access to model legislation and advice about getting it through the legislature. So to check out our site to see some of the things that we're up to, and please feel free to contact us.
Wonderful. And I'll echo what Alex said earlier. You're doing amazing work, and we're so grateful for the initiative and all that you put into it. It's really great to see progress being made on a front that victimizes so many in such a brutal way. So it's really great to have the chance to talk to you and to learn more about that.
Thank you.
All right, folks, you can come join us next week when we do the show again. We hope that you will. And as I mentioned, we do the show live at 11 on Fridays, 11 California time. But if you can't join us live, don't worry. This show will shortly be up on our site at twit.tv/twill, as is our entire archive of shows, as well as information about how you can watch the shows at your convenience on your device of choosing, whether you subscribe in some way or not. All of that is there for you to be able to continue to join us. We hope that you will. We'll be back next week with another episode of This Week in Law. Take care.